Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello. Welcome to this. It is the Rugby Dungeon. Thank you for listening, thank you for subscribing, and thank you for supporting us on Patreon if you are indeed an Egg Chasers Patreon supporter. You can find Egg Chasers every Sunday without fail, or should I say Monday morning in your feed, and you can also find us on Twitter. Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast is at Rugby Podcast. I'm at Jay Beardmore, and yeah, I'll see you there if you wish. Anyway, today I am interviewing Jack Singleton, so enough of this nonsense, let's get on with it. Jack, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I think I'll just probably get into the really serious questions. Are you ready for Christmas?
Not particularly. I've been out today to try and pick up a couple of last minute. Well, I've still got a bit of time. But yeah, I need to sort out a couple more presents.
What do you guys get up to over Christmas? Will Gloucester be holding like their annual Christmas party? What goes on?
We have like a dinner with sort of like wives and girlfriends and stuff, but that's all sort of been thrown into chaos now with the new COVID situation and stuff. So I don't know whether that will be going ahead, but yeah, Christmas is always a difficult one because especially for me, living 2 hours from home and we got a big game Boxing Day, you don't really get to celebrate as much as you'd like to.
2 hours away from what? From work.
My home is Harpenden, where I was brought up.
Ah, right, yeah, I'm with you. So that's an interesting thing, actually, because I thought I knew quite a lot of you. I thought you were Saracens Academy, and then straight from there, you had a few appearances for Saracens, you were linked to the England squad, and then all the salary cap stuff happened, and then you ended up in Gloucester. But that's not the story at all. You were at Worcester first.
Yeah, so I was originally Saracens Academy, actually, and then didn't get signed on there, but luckily my academy coach I got on really well with was Rory Teague at the time. He sort of wanted to keep me on there, but they didn't have, I don't know, it wasn't his decision, and he basically got me sorted out with a contract at Worcester, and yeah, spent 5 years there. Really enjoyed my time there, actually. Still have a lot of good friends there as well.
That's really interesting, yeah. Because Rory Teague was, of course, at Gloucester for a while too, so is that kind of how everything came about?
No, well, I don't think so. So it was weird. When I signed my loan deal with Gloucester, about a week later was when David Humphreys resigned and Johan Ackerman resigned. I was kind of in the headspace of like, I've just signed for Saris and they've been relegated out of the league, and I've just signed for Gloucester and their head coach and DOR have just left. So I was like, I was thinking I was cursed at the time. I never actually got to work with Teague at Gloucester again, unfortunately.
So that's, wow. So that must have been quite a shock, actually, because you do sign on the basis that you're going to get a good coach, a good programme. And to see what happened at Gloucester at that time, I mean, I was very uncertain about what the future of the club was. What were you thinking?
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking as well, because there wasn't like an immediate replacement. To be honest, I wasn't there at the time, and I didn't really know there was anything going on at Gloucester, really. So it all came as a little bit of a shock. But luckily, like, Skivs was announced pretty soon after.
Yeah.
And then got along with Skivs really well and was enjoying my time at Gloucester. And I was playing a lot after the COVID restart, so just decided to stay on, yeah.
Yeah, the Skivington appointment is really interesting because as an armchair fan, which I am, you think of Skivington, and he was a positional coach in London Irish. Now, he's obviously well-known throughout the game, but you've just lost an Ulster great, a Heineken Cup winner there. Was he Heineken Cup winner? Probably. And then, of course, Johan Ackerman, who came with an enormous reputation. And you just didn't know really what Skivington was going to bring. And I think this season in particular, he's absolutely shooting out the lights.
Yeah, I think it was a bit of unknown to start. Like, obviously, he was a young coach. Well, young for a coach. I think the coaches he's brought in, Dom Waldock, again, young. And then there's Kingy, who's really experienced.
Yeah.
And Trev, our scrum coach, I think is a really good balance, to be honest. And like you say, I think last year we were a bit disappointed. A lot of stuff, I mean, you know, we weren't where we thought we should be in the league and stuff like that. And luckily this year, so far, we've sort of turned a bit of a corner.
Yeah, so bear with me here because I am going somewhere with this. But do you remember Michael Vick in the NFL?
I don't know.
So there was a quarter...
Coach or player?
Player. So Michael Vick was a superstar quarterback, got put in jail for fighting with dogs, and then he came back, and it was like massive news. First season, he did really, really well. But some guy came up with a stat that he had more lucky passes than anyone else. And in the next year, it sort of came true, which is all the luck he had one year just completely vanished. I think Gloucester sort of went down the road last year of being the most unlucky team. Because if you look at all of your results, you were losing by 1 or 2 points. And I think, if I'm correct, you got more losing bonus points than any other team. So it just shows you weren't, even though the table suggested that you were a little bit off the pace, turns out you weren't that far off the pace at all.
Yeah, we chatted about that quite a bit in pre-season. Because off the back of a season like that, you can confidence can sometimes take a knock. And then when you actually looked at it, it was like, I think it was like 7 or 8 games were within, I think it was like 5 games were within 3 points, and then it was like 9 were within 7 or something like that.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous. And like, it just showed that we weren't far off. And I think a lot of that is Skivs, obviously this season had a, and the coaches had a full pre-season to work with us. And that helps a lot. But yeah, it was like, we knew we weren't far off. It just, like you say, sometimes it's luck, but you sort of make your own luck. And I think, you know, that's kind of what Skivs instills. It's like, it's not about luck. It's about just working hard and getting your head down.
I've really enjoyed the messages from Skivington in his press conferences. I've seen a few of them so far. And he does seem to put an awful lot of emphasis on the basics, such as work rate, such as set piece. And I think, particularly this year, when the league is so much more competitive and there's so much more parity across it, that's probably one of the reasons that you're doing as well as you are.
Yeah, I think he knew what... I mean, when I was at Worcester and Saris, it was always like Gloucester were inconsistent and they'd rock up one week and win a game that they shouldn't, and then they'd lose a game that they should have had in the bag easily. And I think going to basics solves a lot of that.
Yeah.
Like making sure everyone turns up each week, ready to work hard, be physical, get your set piece and just do your job kind of thing. So I think so far this season, I mean, we've had a couple of... We're still not consistent throughout games. Like, we've had a couple of ones where we've nearly thrown, but I think like we've rocked up to games in a lot better mindset than maybe before. But again, I can't really comment on that because that was sort of before I got to Gloucester anyway.
Yeah, I think these things are like habits, though, aren't they? You get used to winning and it becomes a habit. You get used to losing, and before you know it, you're losing games that you thought you should have won.
Yeah, for sure.
So just tell me about a bit more about Skivington then. He comes through the door. Does he sit every one of you down individually to get to know you? What was your first interaction with him like?
Not particularly. To be honest, I don't deal too much with Skivs. He's got sort of a line-out analysis who does all that stuff for us.
Okay.
He sort of runs the breakdown, but... yeah, it was kind of just like flowed straight into it off the back of COVID.
Mm.
I think my first like proper sit down with Skivs was when he basically offered to sign me on full time when I was here initially on loan, and what his sort of plans were for the club and what ideas they had and stuff like that. So he's quite an honest, straight talker. Like that's why I really, you know, I think all the boys really respect him, because there's no sort of BS with Skivs. It's all sort of straight and narrow.
So just on the signing for Gloucester on a full-time basis, if you hadn't signed that, would you have returned to Saracens? Is that how your deal was structured?
Yeah, so I had another... So when I signed from Worcester, it was a three-year contract.
Yeah.
And I would have gone back with another 2 years, I think, left on my contract with Saris.
I see. And you know, in terms of Saris, obviously they've gone through their own problems, but they're a mighty organisation. What was it that made you want to stay at Gloucester rather than head back over to London, particularly because you're from kind of around there?
Yeah, well, that was one of the initial things. Probably one of the biggest, that and obviously what the club is and winning trophies and stuff like that. And living at home or near home was a big pull for me. And then it was a difficult one because after the COVID restart, I think I played every game under Skivs except for the midweek ones. And I just realized sort of how much I missed playing week in, week out.
Yeah.
And with Jamie there, and I think Jamie had just re-signed another contract, I just didn't see myself getting ahead of him in that Sarri setup. So as much as it was a really tough decision as well. It kind of took me a whole off season to come up with an answer.
Because
I did really enjoy the club. I loved being back home. The lads were all unbelievable. But I think it was just, I missed playing rugby consistently.
Yeah. And to be fair, it sounds like you might have made the right decision there, because your performances over the last few weeks have been particularly impressive. Now, I mentioned this to you over WhatsApp, but are you aware that teams are defending the line-out differently when you're playing as opposed to other Gloucester Hawkers?
No, I wasn't aware of that, no.
Yeah, this is actually a thing. So I was talking to a player, I shan't name the team, but they were saying, when you were playing, they prefer to defend middle and back, and then as soon as you come off, they just want to defend the front and make the hooker throw over, which I think in terms of compliments is about as high as it gets.
Yeah, it is very nice to hear. But, you know, it's very cliche, but it's not always down to the hooker. Like, it's a lot of moving parts, and the hookers tend to get the rap of it when it goes poorly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's vice versa when it goes well. But that is quite nice to hear in terms of compliments. But I mean, it can flip on its head real quick. I remember we were going pretty well all through the season, and then Exeter at home, they got on top of us a little bit at set piece, which was a frustrating one.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. I was chatting to an analyst called Ben Darwin, and he actually said that one of the most important relationships in a rugby side is between the hooker and the second row. And hookers tend to underperform for the first 2 or 3 years because they need to get that timing right with their primary jumper or jumpers. So it's phenomenally difficult. And you're right, hookers do tend to get the blame. And you see so many good throws which are overthrows because someone's just not got high enough.
Yeah, it is a big thing having a good relationship, especially when stuff starts to go wrong as well.
Yeah.
Because say if it is a missed throw, like a lot of hookers don't want to get a death stare. I mean, I've had a few of them from Ed Slater since being at Gloucester. But sometimes it's just about, if you've got that good relationship, you can have like an honest chat and know that it's not someone digging you out.
Yeah.
And then you can get on with your next thing.
Yeah, because
rather than holding on to it.
Yeah, because the easiest thing in the world is to blame the overthrow or whatever it may be, particularly for a wrong call. The wrong calls are the most infuriating.
Yeah, 100%.
How much say do you have as a hooker into, you know, what calls you make, what you think is possible during a game? Are you constantly having those chats?
A little bit. Sometimes when I feel like a movement's not working or there's some, I might give a little bit of input, and then like pre-match it's sort of weather dependent is the kind of question I get, like, are you comfortable throwing to the tail here if it's say blowing a gale and missing with rain, but I prefer to keep sort of my nose out of it and just kind of get on with it, really, and let them, because they're the ones who do like Sunday night meetings and watch all the lineouts. So
oh,
I don't want to end
that?
Up getting... the line-out callers and our analyst will do that. And then they'll put a plan together on that Sunday and then Monday morning, so that we're ready to go. And I don't want to get roped into one of their meetings. So
no,
I enjoy
you don't.
My Sunday evenings.
That's really interesting. I had no idea. And on Sundays of all times.
Yeah, I think they do like a quite. I think the analyst puts a lot in place,
yeah.
And then they'll do a Zoom call, make sure everyone's happy with it, and then send out the sheets.
So, do you guys show up to games week on week with a different set of calls, or do you just emphasize different things within the same set of calls?
Different set of calls most weeks. Like sometimes some calls carry over.
Yeah.
Especially in a game where, say, if we haven't used a lot of lineouts or something like that, then they might carry over. But it's sort of dependent on how teams defend, if they're sort of mirror defense or if they're two pod or
yeah.
Who you want to try win the ball on the weaker jumper, say, or something like that. So
that's astonishing. There is
a lot that goes into it for those boys. There's a lot to think about. I don't envy them.
No, so I always think, well, I don't envy any of you, actually, because I always think one of the ways to get a really efficient set piece is repetition over and over again. But if you're changing what you're doing from week to week, it just really emphasises how much work will go into that by everyone, because these things are complex.
Yeah, they are. I think once you've got like your basic movements sorted, then you can kind of work off that. But because each movement will just be a different version of that or something, or with a dummy somewhere or something like that. But yeah, we do get a lot of reps, and it gets harder as the season goes on, especially now we're on the 4G, that boys' knees start to play up and stuff like that. So sometimes I don't get as many reps as I'd like, but I can understand why when half the boys are struggling to walk after lineup sessions.
Yeah. So without giving the game away, obviously you don't want to say too much, but what are the things that you guys emphasise at Gloucester? What do you think that is giving you this dominant set piece? Because, you know, outside of Leicester, you're pretty much as good as it gets. I mean, probably including Leicester, actually.
I think it's like you said, I think it's just repetition. Skivs has put a massive emphasis on it, and then I think what comes with that is a little bit of confidence. I think because I'm all started well at the start of the year,
yeah,
you know, all the boys are brought into it, and like I said earlier about Skivs, it's a lot of very simple stuff. It's like work hard, see who breaks first, like keep pumping your legs, stuff like that. It's all very simple stuff, but it is just true. It's like who kind of a mindset of like, do we want to break them or let them break us, kind of thing.
I absolutely love that. Yeah,
I was just saying it's good because it gives you, there's not anything to think about other than just working hard. So when you've got that in your head, you're not worried about other things like your technical detail and stuff like that. It makes it easier.
Yeah, I love lineouts, and the reason that I love them so much is, and I think they're disproportionately important compared to the effect that you get, is because I think it's very important for a team to be able to hang their hat on something. So if you have real confidence in a set piece, you say, well, at least we can beat them at that. And then from there, you can build on other parts of the game during the match, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
It's just a point of pride.
I think I realised how important set piece was the more I played. And then especially going into like England camps and going to Sarries as well, that was when I kind of really realised how important set piece is, especially in like test matches and knockout games and stuff like that. Like against Exeter, we had a line out shot 5 metres out, and I think Armand got up and stole it.
Yeah,
and like that could have won us the game at the end of the day. Like I think we're only a couple of points down.
Fine margins.
Yeah, and like you lose them lineouts, and you don't know how the game's going to go. So having something to hang your hat on like that's always nice.
Tell me about this, just changing the subject completely. When I was doing a little bit of Wikipedia research, so, you know, not exactly the most in-depth, it says that you had your debut as a professional rugby player in Russia. Is that right?
Yeah, I did. At Worcester, I think I was 20... I think I was 21. I'd just come off the back of my 20s year. We played NSI away. Luckily, the game got moved from like Siberia to Moscow because the weather was too bad. I remember we were watching whoever they played the week before, and it was in like an absolute blizzard. But yeah, luckily we were in Moscow and it wasn't as cold, but it was still freezing. And we lost actually as well. We
did
lost,
you?
Like, 10-8. It was the worst game I reckon I've ever played in still to this day.
Wow.
It was horrible.
Now, a bit of trivia for you. Do you know the other Premiership player that had his debut against NSI as
Not
a professional? AJ McGinty.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He played Connacht at NSI, but unlike you, he played in Siberia. And I was talking to a few of the guys that went over to watch it, some of the journalists, and they said about 30 minutes in, their phones stopped working because they were too cold. So they had to like hold their phones underneath their armpits just to, you know, just to get some communication.
I think that might have been the game that I was watching. I think it was Connacht or someone playing.
That's it.
And it genuinely looked horrific. If I was there, I would have wanted that called off 100%.
Oh, I'd want to play
that. The Russians absolutely loved it as well. Oh. Yeah, that was bad. Luckily, we got them back at home. I think we put a decent scoreline on them. But
yeah. What were they like to play against, if you can even remember that far back?
We put quite a young side out there because we're a Challenge Cup and we're massively focused on trying to stay up in the Prem at the time.
Yeah.
And they ended up just beating us up physically. Like, the pitch was horrendous. Oh, God, it was so bad. The pitch was horrendous. We had a bunch of, like, 20, 18-year-olds out there, couldn't play rugby. It was just literally just scrum and maul. And, and a bunch of bald Russians beating us up.
Yeah, they
all
have
looked
some...
the exact same.
Exactly. They have some big men there. Sail Sharks,
yeah,
had Val Morozov and Andrei Ostrakov there for a while. And it's weird. I think there's like one province of Moscow which produces rugby players. Well, that's where they came from, at least. And both those men are just they're enormous by Premiership standards. I mean, what they do in the Russian League or in the Challenge Cup or to the Challenge Cup minnows, I dread to think.
Yeah, well, we've signed Kirill. And he's actually been class for us. But yeah, he was like an Olympic ref. I think, I don't know whether he went to the Olympics, but he was trying to go to the Olympics as
really?
A wrestler. And he's like 34 or something. And he is an absolute freak in the gym. I've never seen anything like it.
Wow. So, Sale, do you remember the Moldovan that Sale had? I've forgotten his name now, which is embarrassing.
Yeah, I played against him. I can't remember his name.
I can't remember his name either, which is embarrassing because he's an absolute legend. It will come back to me in a second. Well, he was a similar sort of specimen, an excellent prop, but also an incredible wrestler. No one ever wants to be paired up with him in like the warm-up drills when you've got to wrestle.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think on a few socials, a couple of boys have tried to have a little wrestle with him, and he's just dusted them out pretty quick.
Love it. Absolutely love it. Now, your Saracens time seems interesting to me because you didn't play very much there. When you went back to Saracens, were they looking at you as like not the replacement for Jamie George? But I mean, effectively, they don't sign lads unless they think they're going to be very, very good. So, what was the deal? Were they telling you, "Look, come here, and we're going to be looking at you for England"? How did that all come about that you returned?
So at the time, I'd come off the back of a season with Worcester where I think I played something like 28 games, and I was knackered. And I remember meeting up with them, and they kind of told me about this like 60-40, like going like 60-40 with Jamie and stuff in the Prem, and then cup games would come down to form and stuff.
Yeah,
and I think the issue was I went there off the back of World Cup, so I got in. I started late with them. Played against Gloucester 2 days after getting off the plane from Japan, and then started against Racing the next week. And I didn't have the best game against Racing. And then on my first day, we got told we were deducted the points initially.
Oh, was this the Racing game where Manu Vinopola started?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, it was because, if I remember correctly, and I might be misremembering this, sorry to interrupt you.
No, you're good.
But I think you were given the points deduction, and therefore when you went to Europe, you picked a slightly weaker team to focus on the Premiership, and then they relegated you anyway.
Yeah, so that was the issue. So I went there, played the Europe games, because obviously they weren't focusing on that, and then it was like Prem, we're going to try and make up our points or whatever. So Jamie ended up playing all the Prem games, or most of them anyway, that I can remember. And then we finished like that block of Prem, and it was back into Europe, and then we got told we were relegated for sure. And then it was like, all right, well, now we're going to try win Europe. So then Jamie played all the Europe games as well. Yeah, so it was just like, and I don't blame them, because I was new. I was still trying to learn calls, fit in the system and stuff like that. Yeah, I didn't play as much as I was hoping for.
Yeah.
And that was like, and I didn't realize how much I kind of missed going week in, week out. At the time when I was like leaving Worcester, I was knackered, and I was like 23, 24 at the time. And I was like, I don't know how I'm going to cope like the next couple of years if I'm carrying on doing this. So the appeal of like one game on, one game off, yeah, it appealed to me. But realized it, like, if I knew what I knew now, I don't think that would have been the best decision.
Well, you know, it's easy to say that with hindsight, because you go, you know, you sign at Saracens, you expect to then pick up a few medals and trophies along the way. And yeah, you know, had what happened not happened, you could be looking at season two or three where you are 50-50 with Jamie, because, you know, as you've played more this season, I think you've more than proven your worth.
Yeah, no, that was, yeah, that was what, moving home and the winning trophies, like, was the big thing. And as soon as the trophies were out the picture and stuff, it was, the offer didn't look as good as it once had.
Now, I know this seems like an obvious answer now, but can you just describe, like, the atmosphere in Saracens when they were just handed points deductions? Because I think everyone understands why it happened. We can debate how fair it was, but we understand why it happened. I think a lot of people will look at the punishment and how they had three separate punishments as a little bit unfair. So what was it like within the group every time they announced a different punishment?
It was a bit weird, because it was like, almost, if you don't laugh, you'll cry.
Yeah.
And like, everyone was just like, what on earth is happening at the moment? Because I signed there, obviously, with no idea this, like, I saw it on Twitter that they were getting, like, people were saying they should be investigated and stuff like that. But I actually had no idea what was happening when I signed. And so when I actually got there, it was a bit like, what the fuck is going on? Like, but it was just a little bit of uncertainty of like, obviously there's going to be boys who are going to have to leave to get them under the cap and whatnot. So that was kind of the thing. It was like, and like, I think a lot of the lads who'd been there had been there for a long time together as well. So
yeah,
I think that was probably a bit harder for them than it was to me, who was told on my first day at the club.
Yeah. So what do? They just bring you all in as a group?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Say, look, this is going to happen, because apparently the players had like a day's extra notice that this was coming down before it was released into the press.
No, I don't think. Well, maybe some of the senior boys might have had an idea.
Maybe actually.
But no, I rocked up. hungover from like a 3-day bender in Japan and and got told there was an emergency meeting at 9 o'clock. So I walked into that and was told we were 50 points off zero.
Incredible. What did it start? It wasn't 50 points. What would it start? It might have been 50
points. I think it was like 30, was it maybe? Be 32, 35, something like that.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest compliments ever paid to Saracens was the fact that they gave them the points deduction, and then they worked out and thought, hang on a minute, these guys might actually survive relegation, which was which is a problem. And then they looked at their rules and they went, hang on, if they're automatically relegated, the rules still say that the people that finished bottom get relegated, so there'd be in a situation of relegating Leicester Tigers by the rules and then you guys by default and punishment. So do they bring two teams up, or what happens? So they came up with this amazing solution, which was to fine you pretty much I think it equaled something like the most points ever scored in a Premiership season, just in case they turned around and scored the most points ever scored in a Premiership season.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
So ham-fisted.
It was a ridiculous time, to be fair.
Go on.
But no, it was surprisingly, the mood wasn't as doom and gloom as you'd think. I don't know what it was like before that, obviously, but I still really enjoyed my time there, and the lads were good fun as well, so.
Yeah. Now, they're obviously a very close-knit group size, and you came into them at a very unusual time. But how did they go about integrating you into that team? Because they're fairly famous for their socials and making sure everyone feels part of what they're doing.
Yeah, I think so. I think the day we got told, they ended up just giving us the day off because they were just almost no point kind of training. And then the following week, like I said, we had Racing. And I think we ended up having a Monday night social.
In Paris?
So this was the week building into Paris, which for me was my first Champions Cup game. I was pretty nervous and stuff, and then it was just we're just gonna all get absolutely steaming in a pub. We've hired it out on the Monday, gave us Tuesday off, so I think we only did Wednesday and Friday, or Wednesday and Thursday, but going into that week.
I see. So
you get to know people pretty quick from socials, but I didn't get to go on any of the trips, which is that, and not winning any trophies is probably my one biggest regret. But thing I missed out on.
Yeah. So you were at, oh my God, that's right, St. George's School. Is that right?
Yeah.
Now, that was the school that Owen Farrell went to. Have I got that?
Yes. So Owen and Marrow came to it until sixth form, and then he left.
Got it. So who was left in Saracens from your academy group who you then rejoined when you came back from Worcester?
So in my age group, it was only Tom Whiteley.
Okay.
I think who was actually still there. But there was a couple of my... It was the year above me was Nick Tompkins, Marrow, Nathan Early, obviously he had left at that time.
Yeah.
And then I knew a few of the younger boys like Nick Azikwe as well.
I see. Yeah, Ezekwe is awesome, actually. He is one of the most underrated guys. His lineup work is exceptional. Between him and Mario in the lineup is brilliant.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to playing them. They're going to be... our analyst is going to have a job on his hands that week.
Yeah, because they've got so many options. Both, I mean, their defensive stuff is great, but going forward, they're just very, very hard. Yeah. Very, very hard to stop.
Yeah.
Your England time. When was the first time you encountered Eddie Jones, and did he phone you out of the blue? Did your team manager let you know that you're in England? How did that all come about?
No, so my first time was when I was at Worcester. I was actually on my, it was my 21st birthday, and I was at the races with a couple of mates, and got a phone call off Charlotte, who's the team manager sort of thing, and
yeah,
she basically just said, can you come into camp on Monday? And that was the Lions tour before the one that's just gone.
Yeah.
So it was the Argentina tour. So I went in there. And that was when I met Eddie, and that was the first time I've been in, and then
that was an
eye opener, that one.
So that Argentina tour, I call it the Jamal Ford Robinson tour.
Yeah, how come?
Because he got called up
actually on that tour.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, it's been nice to actually go back to Gloucester and see him. He's good value, Jamal.
Oh, he's an absolute top boy. Brilliant lad. I asked Jamal at the time, and I'm going to ask you the same question now. What did you spend your first England fee on?
What did I spend my first fee on? So I didn't actually get a cap until, 4 years, 3 years later. So I only got my first cap on the in the World Cup warm-ups. But I didn't actually buy anything too drastic. I remember the first time the pay came through and I was like, just out the academy at Worcester, and I was
can only imagine that.
I didn't buy anything too drastic. I think the first time I probably went a bit ham was after South Africa. I got called up halfway through the tour, and then I went to Croatia with a few of the England boys after that, and they're obviously a lot more money than me at the time, and I was just trying to keep up with them. So
you can walk into almost any Premiership car park and work out which cars belong to the England boys.
Yeah, the Rangies and the... Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what I would do with my first 20 grand match fee or however much it was at the time. Probably just buy 20 grand's worth of crated champagne, something like that. Really make a statement.
I had a Citroen C1. I remember walking into Penny Hill Park and there was like a Ferrari and an Aston Martin in front of me. I was just like, I'm so out of place. None of the players' cars, but yeah. I think I actually sold that car with the mindset to go and buy a nice car. And then I ended up just getting a VW Golf, which I've still got today. So
very wise, very wise. Don't be buying flash cars. Save your money.
The boys at Gloucester are trying to talk me into getting a nicer car to get in the Lift Share group. They don't want to get in the VW Golf.
No, do not listen to them. Save your money. So, with England then, I mean, you mentioned before, actually, that you're quite nervous with your European Cup debut. Did you have the same nerves going into camp? Because it does sound quite daunting.
I think the first time I did, especially being the only Worcester player there, Ben Teo had obviously been called up to the Lions. And I knew like the odd lad from 20s, but not really many my age group. A few lads a bit younger than me. So like, when you don't know anyone going in initially, like I wasn't like that was only my first season really playing Premiership as well. I was pretty nervous the first time going in, and then sort of as you get more comfortable in the group, it starts to change, and you feel more like a part of the actual team and stuff.
Yeah, I imagine it is very odd going into a group of lads who you already know of. You don't know them, but you know of them. It's like, it must be, it's a strange kind of introduction process when Owen Farrell says, "Hi, I'm Owen." Well, yeah, I know that. Well, of course, you knew him from Saracens. And as for Eddie Jones, what kind of feedback does he give you as a player? What's he told you that you've got to work on? Because allegedly he tells everyone you've got to work on something.
Yeah, he does. It changes from time to time, but it always comes back to basics, like your set pieces as a hooker. Like you're not going to play test match rugby if you can't throw or scrummage. So that's always the big one. And then a lot of it's put on sort of your head as well. It's like, what do you think you need to get better at, or what do you think your strengths are?
Yeah.
And like sometimes it's not what you need to improve on. It's like you need to start doing more of what you're good at. It changes from time to time, but I went in obviously for the South Africa week, got some good feedback from him then.
Nice. Now, I don't know how to actually ask this. I'll just ask it as I see fit. Do you believe him? Now, what I mean by that is he's renowned for playing mind games or saying things which are a little bit provocative. Do you actually believe him when he says, you need to improve on this? Do you ever get the sense that he might just be looking for a reaction from you?
I don't know, to be honest. I would say I believe him because he's, I think if you don't believe in like your head coach, then there's obviously something going wrong there.
Yeah.
I'd say I probably do believe him. Like sometimes it's hard to, it's not what you want to hear. And sometimes it's like, but he's been around the game long enough that he knows what he wants to see in players and stuff like that. So,
So one of the things you said then, and I'm quite interested in this, I'm sorry if it's a bit nausea, But you said, as a hooker, you've got to do your throwing in. Well, we've spoke about lineouts, scrimmaging. You can broadly tell if a prop's having a good game or a bad game, and there are other things to it, such as, you know, or his second row is pushing or whatnot. But you can sort of look at him and go, yeah, he's, you know, he's good shape, he isn't. How do you assess if the hooker's doing a good job? How do you fight your corner and say, yeah, I did all right, actually, thank you very much?
Couldn't really tell you, to be honest. I think what he wants to see from a hooker is sort of like the almost like leading the front row kind of thing. Being able to manage referees, stuff like that, manage your props. I do know what you mean. It's hard to see when if a hooker's a bad scrummager or something like that.
Yeah.
Unless they're getting popped out the top of the scrum every scrum, but that rarely happens. So no, I think unless you're getting absolutely drilled, then it's hard, and even then you probably blame your props. So
yeah, absolutely you would.
Yeah,
no accountability needed, thank you very much.
Difficult one. Yeah, back five or the props.
How do you go about managing the scrum? And actually, whilst we're on it, how do you go about managing the referee to convey that you are actually right?
It's difficult. It's a lot of, like, especially at the moment, I've got a Georgian, the last couple of games I've been playing with Val Rapava Ruskin, the Georgian prop, who's not the biggest speaker, and then I've got the Russian who's learning in English, Kirill. So trying to figure out what's going on in those two heads, nightmare at the moment. But it's just chatting to the referee, seeing what pictures they've seen, and then trying to relay that back to the prop, because you don't want the prop going up to them every time and saying that, because they'll always have an excuse of like, he's binding here or he's dropping it, something like that. And it's like, right, this is what the referee's told me. If you try to do this, then hopefully that won't paint the same picture for him, kind of thing.
Yeah, because everyone's trying to convince the referee that the other team are illegal, regardless of what it is.
Yeah, regardless. Even the nines are trying to convince the ref. Like, when you see a nine look at a touchy trying to say that he's dropped the scrum, the nines haven't got a clue what's going on.
Oh, no. No, I think that's one of the biggest difficulties with officiating, because I coach at lower level and I look at a scrum and I think I know what's going on, but I don't really know what's going on. How a converted nine, I'm not saying Carl Dixon doesn't know, but I'm just giving you an example. Carl Dixon was a nine. It must be phenomenally hard for him to work out all these moving pieces and to give a cohesive decision. And actually, he might be giving a decision where two infringements have occurred, which is completely possible.
Yeah, 100%. And I think a lot of the time it's just a team that's more dominant will tend to get the decisions, or if it's 50-50, they tend to lean towards the team with the ball, which, like you said, it is. You do have some empathy for the refs, as much as you're infuriated after if you've been pinged a few times. It's impossible to tell on, 70% of scrums who's dropped what, or because someone might have slipped in the scrum and then the other prop gets pinged for hinging or something like that. It's very difficult.
Sorry for the noisy questions, but what are your views on things like axial loading? So just so the listener knows what I'm talking about here, this is when you basically pre-engage using, basically your neck, putting the weight through there. It sounds dangerous, but actually the reason that a lot of hookers like it, a lot of hookers say that they don't, but a lot of hookers do like it, is because it does give you one hell of an advantage if you know how to do it.
Yeah, that's a difficult one, because they tried to get rid of it, I think, 2 years ago. They tried to stop any contact between the head and shoulder of the hookers. And I've actually had some calls and been chatting to Christian Day at the RPA, because they're trying to figure out a way of getting rid of it, because of like injuries in young hookers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, it's like you kind of have to do it, because if you don't, then you'll lose the engagement. And if you lose the engagement, it's more than likely you're going to lose the scrum.
Exactly.
But I've actually got an issue with it at the moment. So my neck's been playing up because of that, basically. And it stopped like some nerves firing down my left side. So, yeah, it is a niggly one. And I don't know whether the thing is, if the moment they change the rules, there'll be someone will find a way to bypass it and load just as much weight. And then you'll have the same issue on something else. So it's a tough one.
You made a really good point there, and one which I haven't really thought of, which is it's about young hookers. Because once you get really proficient at this skill, and it is a skill, when it is explained to me by a different Premiership hooker, you realise, yeah, this is really serious. And you've got these absolute assassins in the front row, and if it's your first or second game out from the academy and it's a competitive game, you might be in trouble.
Yeah, 100%. Especially when how much weight's loaded through, because it's basically the hooker's heads and the prop spines holding the whole weight of like eight people or something like that. So yes, that's what Christian was talking about when he spoke to me, was like young hookers coming through are going to have more neck problems later going forward. But it's like they'll keep changing the rules around the scrum for years, and like you just, there'll always be a way around it unless you basically pre-engage scrums, which no one wants to see that.
I think we're actually in a pretty good place with scrimmaging. When we first started the podcast about 9 years ago now, the number one thing everyone was talking about was injuries at scrum time, and then we changed the engagement sequence and it seems largely to have gone away, except for this issue of axial loading. The only thing I would say though is the more that you remove the skill of scrimmaging and the technique of scrimmaging, the more you're just going to get absolutely massive units. If you just reduce it from something which is quite technical into something which is a brute strength competition, you're going to end up with just some absolute brutes.
Yeah. No, I do know what you mean. I think the technical element, has not it's not gone completely, obviously, but like from back when I was growing up watching rugby, it's definitely slowly drifting away, which again takes away from like the whole thing of rugby of like you can play all shapes and sizes. You don't want to get to the point where it's just some absolute machines in the front row kind of thing. No, I do agree, but I do think scrummaging's in a good place, like you say. I think physios and stuff like that and medical teams are pretty good at making sure boys are on top of their neck strength and stuff to help reduce any risk.
Do you go through all of the prehab type routines and protocols now?
Yeah, I do. I actually had this issue before when I first joined Gloucester. It was like a couple of games in and my neck went again. Well, for the first time. But I was on top of it for a while. And then last year, I played only like 7 or 8 games, I think, because of my hamstring. And so now I've been focusing on not re-tearing my hamstring so much that I've lost doing that rehab stuff for my neck. So it's a niggle, but you're always going to get it in rugby where you focus on one thing and you slip away from the other.
Oh, to me, that I've been talking about this recently on other podcasts, but that to me is the art of rugby. Not knowing what to do, but knowing what not to do, because rugby's such a vast sport. Like you've got to make sacrifices. That's both in terms of the team, i.e., you know, are we going to do lineouts and defence today because you can't do everything. And same for players. Just as you've outlined there, you can't keep on top of absolutely everything.
Yeah, 100%. You can't tick all boxes, so you just got to prioritise and hope that works for you.
Just going back a bit. Talking about young hookers, when you had that season at Worcester when you played 2 million game or whatever it was, who were the older guys who you came up against who you thought were particularly good, particularly at scrimmaging?
The Aussie hooker who was at Tigers,
Plotinau,
yeah. I thought he was class, to be fair. And that was like when Tigers weren't sort of what they were in terms of a big scrimmaging outfit. I remember scrummaging against him and I was like, Jesus Christ, this guy's really strong. He's the one that sticks out for me. I'm trying to think outside of that. He's probably the only one. Gus Creevy, even now, scrummaging against Gus, I find, because I was at Worcester with Gus.
Yeah.
Only for a year, and then even scrummaging now, he's a tough hooker.
Wow, so I would never have guessed that about Gus Creevy, which is stupid because he's Argentine. Do you know what it is? It's like, do you know when people think Cristiano Ronaldo can't head a ball because he's so good at everything else? Well, that's what they used to think. They don't think it anymore. Because he's so good at throwing off, out the back offloads and whatnot. You forget he's actually class at the basics too. As for Plotinau, David Flatman tells a story of when he played against Plotinau. I think either England age grades or England... No, it must be English age grades because he only had one cap at England. And he said, started a hooker, Tighthead went down, so he just went over to Tighthead and absolutely dominated there instead.
Yeah, he was a freak. Yeah, he was very good. I also remember I'd never played against him, and kind of happy, kind of gutted I didn't, but the first year Worcester were in the Prem, I remember he put on an absolute clinic and just destroyed our scrum.
I bet.
And everyone I've spoke to can't speak highly enough of how good he was.
Yeah, yeah. Front rows don't get nearly enough recognition. And one of the things which annoys me the most about commentary is when... Oh, no, actually, rugby in general, the writers, not all the commentators, but some of them, is when they talk about the scrum as if it's something to be ashamed of, when actually it's probably the best thing about rugby. It's what makes rugby so unique.
Yeah. I think I know the commentator you're chatting about there. Yeah,
Austin.
Completely agree. Yeah. He hates the scrum, doesn't he?
I don't get it.
Jesus. Every game you hear him complaining about it, it's like, just let it go, mate.
Yeah. I mean, some of the best sequences of rugby I've ever seen, I think they all involve scrummaging. So there was an epic at the Rec where Sale had Bath in the corner for the best part of 8 minutes, scrum after scrum after scrum, resulting in a Sale Sharks penalty try. That's how I remember it. Whether that is actually true, I don't know. The one that you will remember, and I just think it is still some of the best television I've ever seen. Do you remember Wales up against France? And yeah, it went for 100 minutes. 20 of those minutes were scrummaging.
And then trying to get their tight head off and the French doctors coming on and stuff. Yeah, it was a nightmare, wasn't it?
That was awesome.
We had a 100-minute game against Bath, actually, at Worcester.
Did you?
Where we got stuck in that. I think we were like a couple of points down. We were on top of them in the scrum. They had two yellow cards and we just couldn't get the penalty try. And yeah, I think I got subbed off at like 98 minutes or something ridiculous. So I'd played 80 that game.
Wow.
Then we had 15 minutes or whatever of scrums. And then they decided to take me off the one, and we ended up scoring off that one. So it was a good decision in the end. But
well, you know,
I've just played 98 minutes. Like, why on earth am I coming off now?
That's awesome. That's absolutely awesome. The my favourite comment in the Welsh game was when Rob Evans, the Welsh loose head, I think, loose head, when the French are rolling about and trying to get the new tight head on, goes, "It's all right, ref. I'll play against anyone," which sounds great, particularly if you won. But you didn't. You got battered the next scrum.
Yeah, sometimes it doesn't go who does it.
I do appreciate the sentiment and the confidence, though.
The confidence, yeah.
Let's finish off with some more Gloucester chat, because I'm so massively impressed with where this team is going this year. What do you think the upper limit is for Gloucester this year, and where do you think that you'll end up finishing?
I don't think we never really set out a target, even in pre-season. Like, mm-hmm. Skivs never gave us like a top six or top four or anything like, or Champions Cup rugby. He just kind of said, like, if you're one of the, like, because we train at King's Home now, there's photos of like great Gloucester sides all over winning trophies and stuff like that. And he was like, how do you boys kind of want to be remembered and stuff?
Yeah.
Is that, do you want to go down as Gloucester legends, or do you want to just be another Gloucester team that just fades into the distance? So, you know, I don't know where the limit is for this team. I think the good thing we've got at the moment is there's no real egos or superstar kind of players. It's just a lot of guys who work hard like Skivs wants. And I think we're only really at the start of our journey at the moment. Like, I think two and a half years in, including that COVID season, and I think we can really start to kick on, and all being well and we keep boys fit. And we've had like some good news recently of a couple of lads re-signing, like Aki, and
that's a good signing, man.
Yeah, it's class. I was praying he was going to stay, because he's been unreal for us.
Oh, he's just he's just one of those players that brings everything together. He makes everyone around him better. I think that's probably 100%. The best thing to say about him.
And the games where we missed him in that Exeter game, and I mean, so did Exeter missed all their international boys, but I think you can tell our attack slips off a little bit when Aki's not there.
Yeah.
Like, the way he plays, he's just been class for us. So, that's a big re-signing, and Rue's been... Ruan Ackerman's been class for us as well. He's an absolute machine.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I don't know if this means anything at all, really. But one of the things I like about Gloucester and the squad is certainly the boys that I've interviewed in the past and have had interactions with, they're just all incredibly down to earth. It sounds like a cliche, but you sort of get a sense of an organisation. And I wonder if that's, you know, because of the necessity of where these players have come from. I mean, if you look at Atkinson in particular, he is great. He is a great example. His career didn't even really take off until he came to Gloucester, and he came to Gloucester from Bedford. So, you know, you do get kind of rooted when you've gone through that process.
Yeah, we've got a couple ex-Bedford boys and a few lads who've been around in the champ, like even Chris Harris, he was at Rotherham. You know, again, like, he's someone who's like a key part of our squad, and he's like the most down-to-earth guy I reckon I've met. So
I've interviewed him.
The other thing is like, with Skivs and Ludds, our captain, like, Ludds is probably epitomises it. Like, he's just a grafter, like, nothing fancy, and he's not afraid to say anything to anyone. Like, if boys are playing up or doing something stupid or not working hard enough, like, he's very happy to let them know.
Yeah, particularly as he sets that standard too, which is quite important.
Yeah. He's been class.
Just one other thing which I forgot to ask you. Did you have a junior club? Were you affiliated to anyone before you became a professional?
So I played at Harpenden. RFC was my club growing up, and yeah, even then I was kind of just playing with mates, never thinking about actually trying to make it in rugby. It wasn't until I was like 17 which I was like, I might be able to have a crack at this.
Yeah, awesome stuff. Well, look, I'll let you go, because if we're going to talk about lower level rugby, that's it, which I love talking about, and you've already done just over an hour, so I shall let you get off and have your tea.
Thank you very much, and it was a pleasure to chat to you.
Absolutely, Jack. All right, take care, mate, and speak with you soon.
Cheers, catch you soon.
Thanks a lot, mate.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.